You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Jemima Houston tōku ingoa, nō mai haere mai ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to the Wednesday Wire for today. This is the 16th of February. My name is Jemima and I'm your host, and producing the show today is Christina. How are you going?
Kia ora, Jemima. I'm enjoying the last of the sun before it inevitably turns to shit.
I know. Let's hope, you know, I feel like coming... I'm a Christchurch born person, and I feel like Auckland still provides some pretty nice weather through the rest of the year. But you know, there are some dreary days here as well. We've got some good stuff coming up on the show for you today. Whai Akine, what's coming up, Christina?
First of all, we start off with Dear Science with Alan Blackman. Today we chat about scientists collecting samples from an asteroid, the first photos taken from a brand new telescope, including a selfie,
Ooh-hoo.
And the link between personality traits and the music we listen to, possibly. I also speak with Auckland Pride Executive Director Max Tweedy, as well as Dr. Elizabeth Kitikere from the Green Party. We discussed the passing of the Conversion Practices Prohibition Bill in Parliament last night.
Cool. And then I also speak to the ACT Party Deputy Leader, Brooke Van Velden, also about the Conversion Therapy Ban Bill passing last night. However, we also have a quick chat about the anti-mandate protests taking place in Wellington on the Parliament lawns. And finally, Anika from Morning Glory. You've been hearing her all morning, but we've got her on again for The Wire. She is speaking to Colin Hurst from Federation Farmers about the last few weeks of rain and the cyclone over the weekend causing widespread damage to crops across the country and what that means for the supply chain. He aho o whakaaro, I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces. So tuku pātui mai, you can send us through a text on 5395 or Wai Mai Rānei, give us a call in studio on 309 3879. Also, after the show, ko wā e wariwari e ahi ana koutou, te whakarongo ki ēnei kōrero anō, hei pakihiri rokiroki mā runga i te pai, tukutuku o irarangi poho, mi haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. If you haven't already heard me say that many a time. If you need to check out the website, 95bfm.com, there's some really cool stuff there, so do check it out. But anyway, enough of me rambling, let's get into some science.
Wonderful, majestic world around us, it's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Welcome back to Dear Science, and again we've got Alan Blackman joining us live in the studio, which it obviously makes for better sound quality compared to when we're doing it from home, so at least you've got that going for us at the moment.
Amen. And just to mention, all the back episodes of Dear Science are on the website.
Yes. Exactly. So 95bfm.com if you haven't checked it out.
For sure. Just a cheeky plug, as usual. So we've got some exciting stuff today. The first topic that we've got is asteroids. So, you know, you see them in very awful action films all the time. But we've recently been able to, well, I say we, not me personally,
well,
but
humankind.
Humankind has made some big steps in that we found some a way to get samples of asteroids and find out what they're made of. Mm. So tell us more about that.
Yep. No, that's very, very cool. So I guess the first question is, what are asteroids? Mm. And so they have another name, they're called minor planets. So they're little chunks, or indeed quite big chunks of rock that are floating around in space. They generally live between the orbits of Mars and Jupiter. There's a big thing called the asteroid belt there.
Right.
And the biggest asteroid is a minor planet called Ceres, and that's around about 1,000 kilometers in diameter. So for comparison's sake, the moon is around about 3,500 kilometers in diameter.
Wow.
And Pluto is about 2,400 kilometers in diameter. So the moon's actually bigger than Pluto. There we go. Everyone's learned something today. There
my
we go.
Goodness.
So getting back to asteroids, not trying to get sidetracked here. So basically people want to know what asteroids are made of, obviously. And so some very enterprising scientists in Japan managed to send a probe up in the year 2010, and this was called Hayabusa. And what they managed to do was to land this, in fact, on an asteroid, pick up a sample of the asteroid itself, and bring it back to Earth, which is really, when you think about it, pretty bloody amazing. Mm-hmm. Quite astonishing stuff. And so they have just repeated this. And so in 2018, Hayabusa 2 landed on a minor planet or an asteroid called the snappy name 25143 Itokawa. Oh, sorry, wrong one. Actually, it's 162173 Ryukyu. Sorry, got that wrong.
In case you wanted to Google it, that's
yeah,
the one.
Absolutely. And so that landed on an asteroid in 2018, on that particular asteroid, and it came back to Earth in December 2020. So they landed it out in the outback in Australia. Mm. Pretty much all of the actual spacecraft itself burned up, but the container that was holding this precious cargo managed to survive. And it didn't go above sort of 60 degrees, apparently, which is fabulous. And they found it. They got a whopping great 5 grams of sample from this asteroid.
Wow.
And this 5 grams of material is probably the most valuable material on the planet when you think of the number of dollars that it took to get this 5 grams of stuff. And so since December 2020, they have been analysing this, and they've just published the results of their analysis in 3 papers, in fact, and it's probably 3 of many, I would guess, where they're looking at what this meteorite, or what, sorry, not meteorite, getting ahead of myself, what this asteroid is made of. Now, why the interest? Okay, so I mentioned meteorites there. So meteorites are these things that you know, if you're really lucky, you sometimes see in the sky at night, you know, big trail of light, et cetera, et cetera. So they are basically, you know, little bits of rock, remains of asteroids, whatever, that are coming through the Earth's atmosphere and burning up. Now, what we know about asteroids is that about 75% of them are very, very, very rich in carbon, okay? And so they've got these organic molecules, they've got amino acids, and some people think that life on Earth may have started because these asteroids brought these particular molecules to planet Earth, and they made it, and they survived re-entry, right, and et cetera, et cetera. But in terms of meteorites, which are derived from asteroids, only about 5% of those meteorites are found to be high in carbon. And so that's been a query, or a question that they've been asking for many years now. So why the lack of meteorites that contain a lot of carbon? Well, they basically think they've got the answer now, because they've analysed this asteroid material. They've found it's very, very, very fragile, very, very porous, and they say it sort of resembles a clay. And basically, simple answer is that it doesn't survive re-entry. So it's that porous, it's that brittle, whatever, that basically most of these things burn up in the atmosphere. Yeah, yeah. So simple answer to a relatively complex question, I guess. But I guess watch this space, because lots more will be done on these samples. They have yet to do the chemical analysis and stuff like that, so they're really only looking at the bulk outside of these things at the moment, but there'll be lots more to come. So, you know, fabulous stuff, really
amazing,
really amazing. And if you go on online, you'll see the actual spacecraft itself actually colliding with the asteroid and sort of bouncing back up, because they wanted not only to get a surface sample, but they wanted to get something under the surface. Oh, so basically, oh, wow. that involved like going bonf.
Grabbed it.
Yeah, basically, yeah. Yeah.
Incredible.
Like one of those claw machines, like. somebody's texting saying, is this like the movie Don't Look Up, where people want to mine precious materials from meteors? Has anybody seen Don't Look Up? I haven't. I know it's about meteors.
I've watched the first third. so thanks for spoiling that one for me.
Well, no, it's definitely about it. Yeah. Yeah, perhaps.
Well, I mean, people have said this, that, you know, there could be valuable minerals out there, and go mining on the moon and everything. Oh, good grief. No, not a great idea, really, is it?
Yeah.
Is
yeah.
it?
The movie is a satire, but it could be very accurate.
Yeah.
In case.
Yeah. Yeah.
And onto our second topic, which is also about space.
Yep.
The James Webb Space Telescope has taken its first photos, including a selfie. And I don't know how to explain this because that's just kind of bizarre. It's a telescope just taking a selfie. But what's going on
it,
there?
Well, it was launched, the James Webb Telescope, as essentially the successor to the Hubble Space Telescope, which is coming sadly to the end of its useful life and has done amazing things and there's amazing photos out there. But this one's going to be even better. So this one's going to be able to see essentially further back into the past. So all the way back towards the Big Bang, some sort of 13.8 billion years ago. So all of the radiation that came from that, it's still sort of out there, you know, and it's travelling towards Earth, et cetera, et cetera. So it's just a matter of being able to see that. So hopefully this new James Webb telescope will be able to do that. So it was launched on Christmas Day last year, and now it is in place. It's all basically set to go. So it's in a special spot called the Lagrange Point 2.
I love all these numbers in these space. All of these space things are like, number and, this one.
The physicists will know all about Lagrange points, but essentially it's a point in space where all of the gravitational fields of the sun and the Earth are in the right position for this thing to sort of orbit in a relative constant position compared to those two things, essentially.
That's got to be really precise.
Yeah. And so this thing, if you've seen a photo of it, it's got 18 mirrors. So these big hexagonal gold covered by the look of the mirrors. And so the first photos that have come through from this are in fact 18 photos of the same thing. So they're just an out of focus, fuzzy white blob of a star that is in the constellation Ursa Major, or the Great Bear. And you might think, well, that doesn't look very good. Well, they're absolutely wrapped with it, because now what this allows them to do is to align the mirrors so that these 18 fuzzy blobs are all focused into the one single, beautifully clear blob, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that's basically the guts of it. So there's going to be plenty more from this. This is going to, there's going to be fantastic discoveries come from this particular piece of apparatus. It's going to be quite extraordinary. So it's going to start operation, I think they said about sort of about 6 months operation for real and stuff like that, but at the moment it's just fine tuning, getting it all in focus, etc., etc., and then
incredible.
Watch the space. Amazing stuff.
And so, sorry, just to go to the selfie point, I don't know whether I missed that. Did it take a photo of itself?
It did. It took a photo of itself, which they didn't think was possible because there wasn't enough light, supposedly, to be able to take a photo of itself. But indeed there was. So they were absolutely rapt about that as well.
Exciting stuff.
Great. Yeah. Selfies, you know, working towards science, scientific discoveries. Who would have thought?
I know.
But that's exciting news as well.
Yeah.
And finally, this one's a bit of a pivot, new science is
Careful, are we going to call this science?
Science, and we say that in the air quotes. There are possibly some positive correlations between personality traits and the kind of music that people dominant in these traits listen to.
How can you determine that? Isn't personality traits something that's subjective anyway?
There's the question. Okay, so you go to the website of the study, and you're affronted by two quotes. Okay, these are worth reading out. So, those with neurotic traits in the USA are as likely to be into Nirvana's Smells Like Teen Spirit as people with a similar personality living in Denmark or South Africa. Waha. Even better, I like this, it does not matter where a conscientious person lives, they are unlikely to enjoy Rage Against the Machine. Well, colour me conscientious. There you go.
I'm just trying to say, like, what sort of person would describe their own personality trait as neurotic? So in my personality, I feel like I'm quite a neurotic person, and so that's why I like Nirvana.
Yes,
like, what?
Isn't it based on like the big five of personality traits that have been scientifically proven?
Well, careful with that. Yeah.
Again, in air quotes. So,
this isn't chemistry that we're talking about.
No. Fair enough.
So a fellow by the name of Dr. David Greenberg, who is at Cambridge University and also associated with the University in Israel. So 350,000 participants from all around the world, from 50 countries, greater than 50 countries.
That's a lot of people.
Basically, they are all, as you say, self-picking their personality types. So And then they get to listen to 25 pieces of music and rate whether they like it extremely, whether they hate it extremely, or a whole lot of variations in between. And on the basis of that, he has come up with these supposed correlations. Okay, so if apparently you are an extrovert or display extroversion, should we say, you like contemporary music. There seems to be a correlation with that. And contemporary music, apparently rap, electronica, Latin, and Europop.
Mm-hmm, right.
If you're a conscientious person, you like unpretentious music. I like this.
Right.
Unpretentious. What music is unpretentious? Country music. There we go.
Of course.
Which reminds me of the wonderful Bob Newhart quote where he said that he doesn't like country music and he doesn't mean to denigrate those that do. And denigrate means to put down.
Dear, oh dear. Are you a conscientious person out there listening that likes country music? Yeah. Text us in, 5395. Yeah, yeah.
If you're an agreeable person, you apparently like mellow and unpretentious music. So that means you like soft rock, R&B, adult contemporary, and country.
Mm.
I don't think anybody likes all of those. But anyway. No.
Maybe if you are like really agreeable, people just ask you if you like country.
Yeah.
And then instead of having an argument, you're like, yeah, love it.
Yeah.
And apparently if you're a very open person, then you like mellow, contemporary, intense, and sophisticated music, which is pretty much everything, apparently. Mm. Now, as you might guess, I've got problems with this.
So I took
the test myself.
Okay.
Yeah, I thought, yeah, okay, so this is a real scientific endeavor, or mm-hmm. whatever, pseudoscience, whatever. And took the test, and as you do, you rank yourself in terms of your personality, and then you listen to these 25 pieces of music. And then you're all set for the results. And then they give you the sort of vague results. And then you click on the next one and it says, for only $9.99, you can get your e-report. And I thought, right, that's not
Uh-oh.
Real. This is not yeah. real oh, academia. Man. This is not.
About as scientific as a multi-level marketing scheme.
I just feel, for me, all of that is very subjective, right? I feel talking about personality traits is a subjective thing because how you interpret yourself mm-hmm. is very different to how other people interpret you.
Absolutely.
Or like, perceive you
yep.
and then music is so subjective
yes.
like how yep. on earth could you say some music is pretentious and some isn't without that being dependent on who the person is determining whether yeah. a piece of music is pretentious but hey
what if someone's listening to BFM right now going am I pretentious
yeah cool yeah
so you can
mellow
you can,
music
you can go and check that out if you so want to but oh, gosh, you're just adding to the 350,000 participants and probably advancing this guy's academic career. So
yeah.
I don't know.
Maybe leave it alone.
Possibly
for the best.
Yeah.
Well, that's all the time we have for Dear Science Day. Thanks again, Alan.
Okay, see ya.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
You're on the Wednesday Wire with Jemima and Christina. We'll be right back with some more good news bits for you after this.
Hey, what's a seven-letter word for Street Fighter?
What? I don't know.
Okay, what about treasure trunks in six?
No idea, and I don't care.
Shit, you're useless. Don't you know anything?
Look, I know tonight at Ponsonby Social Club there's Pateko Beats with Enrique Morales, Miguel BD and Lance Bentley, plus DJ Bobby Brazuca.
Oh, go on.
And tomorrow, DJ Andy JV.
Sweet as, one of those actually solved 13 across. Cheers.
Same old Ponsonby Social Club, 152 Ponsonby Road.
95 BFM are teaming up with MOTAT to celebrate 100 years of radio in Aotearoa this Sunday.
From 10 to midday, Johnny from BFM Drive will be broadcasting live from MOTAT before switching into DJ mode till 2 with Doc Sportello taking over the dance floor through to 4. So come on down, build your own radio, learn about the history of telecommunications and soak in the sounds. 100 years of radio, this Sunday, February 20th. Broadcast on 95 BFM 10 to 12 and in the flesh at MOTAT all day till 4. Go to 95bfm.com.
Oh, my favourite jazz solo of all time. You know that one that's like...
Nah, I feel like they definitely improvise like...
You guys still talking about jazz?
Yeah, just trying to work it out, man.
Do you know Grover?
Washington, Grover Washington,
no,
Limelight, great album.
Grover from the Muppets.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I guess so.
Does he like jazz?
All kinds of people love jazz.
The 95 BFM Jazz Show. Sundays at 12 with Blind Mango Chutney, Deaf Jim, Miss Dom, Francis Chan, or Dr. Mark Baines. The 95 BFM Jazz Show, 12 till 2 p.m. Sundays. Jazz, they just make it up as they go along.
Irirangi Poho, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
Last night, the third reading of the Conversion Practices Prohibition Bill passed its reading in Parliament. The bill will make it illegal to change or suppress someone's sexual orientation, gender identity, or gender expression. Performing conversion practices on minors can now carry a prison sentence of 3 years. The bill passed last night with almost unanimous support, with the exception of 8 National MPs. This morning, I spoke with the Executive Director of Auckland Pride about the passing of this bill and what it means for the rainbow community. This news has kind of made headlines around the world. What does this mean for the rainbow community moving forward?
I mean, I think what it means for our community is that Parliament has sent a loud and clear message to queer New Zealanders, but also to all New Zealanders, that these practices are abhorrent, they're harmful, and that they won't be tolerated in Aotearoa anymore. And that is a really powerful message, because conversion practices kind of striked at the heart of what it meant to be queer or trans. It was an attack on our identities. And so to have these practices banned not just affirmed at the identities of who, you know, queer and trans people, you know, who we say we are, but it actually sends a clear message that actually who we say we are is accepted, loved, and part of this modern Aotearoa, which is incredibly exciting. And around the world, I think, sends a louder message that actually, you know, Aotearoa is one of the first countries in the world to put a national ban on this practice. And so I think it'll encourage other lawmakers around the world and other activists around the world to push even harder, because they'll see that it's possible. So it's really exciting.
This bill passed with near unanimous support, except for 8 National MPs. Do you think that this bill could have been stronger and wider reaching?
I think there were a couple of things that we would have liked to see, you know, with regards to the strengthening of the bill. So I think, for example, the requirement for the Attorney General to sign off on prosecution was, we thought, a threshold that was quite high, and also kind of exemplified that concern was kind of realised when the Shadow Attorney General voted against the bill last night. So, you know, of course, there are concerns around, you know, that being politicised, and so that was a concern we raised. I also think that there were opportunities to strengthen the role of the bill to support survivors who'd been through conversion therapy, so ACC, you know, funding for counselling, that kind of thing. I don't think the bill needed to be more wide-reaching. I think the bill was really good at clearly defining what a practice was and defining what a practice wasn't and outlawing those. So I think, look, it is a pretty good bill. I think there were obviously things that could have been improved about it, but, you know, this bill will change lives.
Obviously, banning conversion therapy isn't the same as ending it completely. And what are the next steps for ending these practices in New Zealand?
I think the kind of first step is just seeing the impact of the legislation, seeing if it actually makes a difference anecdotally. I think one of the most interesting places that where we'll be hearing this is within the medical profession, especially around, you know, trans and non-binary identities, because, of course, conversion practices in those spaces were already deemed an unethical practice within the kind of medical profession code. But the Counting Ourselves report showed that I think 16% of trans and non-binary individuals had experienced conversion practices in a medical setting. So I think what will be really interesting is that to see the impact of this legislation from an anecdotal perspective and see if it actually has worked. And of course, you know, I think what we are all very aware of is that this bill is a deterrent. We don't think we'll see widespread prosecutions as a result of this bill. We think it will be a deterrent, and it sends a message, and I think that message is really strong. So I think, you know, what we will kind of continue to monitor is the impact of the legislation, but also see, you know, I think conversion practices don't exist in a vacuum either. They exist within the context of an unaccepting society or unaccepting individuals of you know, queer and trans people. So I think the work to root out conversion therapy actually lies in the kind of wider program of work that needs to be done to achieve justice and equity for our rainbow communities, so that there aren't actually people who believe that those types of practices need to be carried out in the first place.
So it is a good start for kind of moving towards a more inclusive society, isn't it?
It's a fantastic step, and I think there's been, you know, steps, you know, going back as far as 86.
Wow.
And every kind of step along that way has helped to change society. I mean, even you think of the marriage equality bill. There aren't that many people at the moment that would think that that is something that shouldn't be in place. And so I think that these types of legislative achievements are really important in just like furthering the conversation, furthering progress, and furthering society's acceptance of our rainbow communities.
I also spoke with the Green Party's rainbow spokesperson, Dr. Elizabeth Kitakere, about the bill and the Green Party's fight to bring it to Parliament. I first asked her about her thoughts and feelings about the bill finally passing.
I'm really excited about it. It's a big achievement for our country, and it means other people will follow our lead in this. But it sends a clear message that this is not the kind of behaviour that's acceptable in this country anymore. And to those who have suffered for it, that we recognise the trauma that they have faced, and we want to do something about it.
And obviously conversion therapy practices have been debunked and proven to be harmful for quite a while now. Why has it taken so long for conversion therapy to be banned in Aotearoa?
I think that it was invisible for a long time, and the nature of it is often quite secret, because when something is happening in your own home and in your own community or your place of worship, then you're part of that community or that whānau, and you don't want to get anyone else in trouble. And sometimes you don't recognise the situation you're in until you leave it, and the discomfort might grow, and the mental, psychological dissonance might grow. But it's really difficult to, sometimes to reach out for help. And I think the call has been growing for a long time to get rid of this practice. And I'm just really pleased that we're finally at that point.
You launched a petition around this time last year to ban conversion therapy. The petition gathered more than 150,000 signatures. What impact do you think that had in forcing the government to act?
I think that they, that's it, it forced the government to act. Absolutely, they ran on conversion practices, on banning it in their campaign. But when I wrote to the minister as soon as I got elected, they said they had no plans to bring it to the House anytime soon. So making the petition and the huge response that we got from New Zealanders was just saying, actually, you need to put it on the agenda now. And that's what they did. And now, a year later, nearly to the exact date, it's in law. And so we will take full credit for that, because they were not going to do it then.
It's a monumental step for the LGBT community. What does the passing of this bill mean for the community moving forward?
It's another step for our community. It's the recognition of the rights of rainbow people. It's recognition of some forms of discrimination that are only faced by people in rainbow communities. And we acknowledge there are many people out there who don't belong to local groups, that aren't connected online with other people, and that they're individuals throughout this country who, I hope this sends a message to all of them to say that there are people here in Parliament, in the community, who are fighting for them, who are aware of the issues that are going on, and will keep doing that. So it's a big deal. And I'm getting messages from around the world from people who are really excited to see this happen.
This morning on Breakfast, producer Zoe also spoke to National Party Health spokesperson Dr. Shane Reti about the passing of this bill. Dr. Reti was one of the 8 National MPs who voted against it.
The bill to ban conversion therapy in Aotearoa was passed last night after its third and final reading. It's a huge overdue win for the LGBTQIA plus communities here in Aotearoa. Conversion therapy is an awful practice with incredibly negative, long-lasting effects on those who have been subjected to it. And it's not grounded in any science. As health spokesperson, would you say that the passing of this bill would also be a win for legitimising our health practices in Aotearoa?
So certainly 99% of the bill is supportive and around the abhorrent practices that you're talking about that have been accompanied with gay conversion therapy that just quite simply needed to stop. And I think what this bill has done is that it's encouraged a level of conversation between professionals and the media and the public around what is reasonable and acceptable practice. So normally these sort of things would be driven out of the medical fraternity. This has probably actually been more driven out of social environment and then picked up by Parliament. So it's normally a medical fraternity developing the policies and the concepts, bottom up, if you like. This is actually top down at one level with Parliament mandating it, but it's in response to a ground up response from social avenues. So it's a little bit different and kind of interesting in that respect. So that's been useful, that where there's clearly an abhorrent medical practice, that the voice of the community can lift up and Parliament will make the call instead of the medical organisations. There remains some concern, I believe, around the reasonable right of a reasonable parent to have reasonable discussions with their children, and we'll have to see how that plays out, whether that turns out to be a legitimate concern or not, may well end up in front of the courts. But here it is, as of last night, this bill has passed.
And almost all MPs voted in favour of the bill, and the eight who didn't, yourself included, were from the National Party. The leader of End Conversion Therapy New Zealand, Chenille Lal, has said that we never want to see those eight National MPs who voted against conversion therapy at Pride ever again. Do you have a comment or response to this?
Oh, well, as I said, all these discussions need to be with mutual respect, and so I'll respect their view and mutually expect them to respect mine. The concern was very clear, the reasonable right of a reasonable parent to have a reasonable conversation with their children. Clarity was sought with supplementary order papers seeking clarity to be included in the bill, and they were voted down. So, you know, conclusions can be drawn from that.
That was Auckland Pride Executive Director Max Tweedy, Greens MP Dr Elizabeth Kirikiri and Nationals Shane Reti talking about the banning of conversion therapy in Aotearoa. You're listening to The Wire. If you have any thoughts, please send us through a text on 5395.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with ACT Party Deputy Leader Brooke Van Velden.
This week, I spoke to Brooke about the passing of the bill that will ban conversion therapy practices in New Zealand and what ACT's perspective was on this becoming law. We then also speak about the anti-mandate protest taking place on the parliamentary lawns in Wellington right now. The protest is in its ninth day, despite the protesters having been trespassed from the grounds a few days ago. I asked Brooke about how the MPs are feeling about the protest and when she thinks the sit-in may end. Here is my conversation with Brooke now. So yesterday, the bill banning conversion therapy practices passed its third reading, meaning that it will come into law. This is a real win for New Zealand's rainbow community, and we'll see harmful conversion practices criminalised. ACT voted for the bill. How do you feel about it now that it has passed?
Oh, look, I think it's really positive that so many members of Parliament voted in support of banning conversion practices that are harmful last night. The concerns that we had heard through the Select Committee were alleviated by the changes to the law and also by the comments that the Minister made in the House. So the ACT Party was very happy to support banning harmful practices. And we were also very happy that it struck the right balance between people's right not to be in a harmful practice, but also that right of freedom of speech that parents and children are able to converse with each other at fear not to be penalised.
Let's move on to protests that are taking place in Wellington at the moment on the parliamentary lawns. Just to start off with, you're in and around Parliament pretty regularly. How is it sort of feeling there?
Well, not too much has really changed for us other than, going into Parliament, we're now using the back entrance rather than the front and the forecourt because it's been blocked to everybody. But what really is a shame is that people who are trying to get to school are feeling vulnerable and feeling threatened and not sure that they actually want to go to school. And people who are trying to get into their offices or trying to do business down this end of town are feeling like there is a form of abuse happening, and I think that's a real shame. We would support a lawful protest, but unfortunately what we have seen is unlawful actions, abuse and threatening actions to members of the public, and it's sadly affecting the wider Wellington region, not just Parliament.
Absolutely. And it's been interesting seeing those sort of comments online and also through the media about cafes and restaurants nearby, and then, yeah, hearing about school children as well just making their way to school. It is definitely, I don't know, it's really sad that a protest is making people feel unsafe.
Yeah, it is. And look, we get protests down here in Parliament, it feels like nearly every day. And people come here to air their genuine grievances. And that's what we actually do need in a good democracy, is that people can to voice their views before Parliament. But what we're seeing here is it's going a little too far. You know, people's lives are being disrupted. People are talking about their ability to have rights and freedoms under the law, but they're severely impinging on the rights of business owners and other people feeling safe being able to go about their business in Wellington. I think, though, there are some wider concerns we do actually need to talk about. And one of the points around the protests is, of course, talking about the mandate. Now, ACT has always said that the mandates were actually quite heavy-handed, and we would allow for a vaccine or test regime. So people actually, if they're a business owner, have the ability to say to their staff, I want people who are working here, we've done our risk analysis, to feel safe, they can have a vaccine, or we allow them to have a testing requirement as well. And so there are a few people who are scattered throughout the country and also at the protest who do have a genuine concern that they have lost their jobs, they've lost their incomes and their livelihoods, and that stirred up a lot of angst and anxiety. And I can sympathise with that to a degree. But where I disagree is by airing those concerns in a way that is making a lot of other people feel unsafe, and it's disrupting business.
Is there any sort of talk in Parliament about when perhaps this might end? Do you have any sort of idea about how long it could go on for, whether there will be a major intervention? You know, there's been reports of police impounding cars, and there have been deterrents such as music being played to encourage people to leave. Do you have any thoughts about when something like this might end?
Oh, look, if I knew, that would be the $1 million question. I think yeah. The police would also really like to know that too. But I think some of the actions that have happened over the last few days haven't helped to slow the progress of the protest. I mean, you look at the actions that the Speaker did on Friday and on the weekend, which, in my opinion, were just childish and a little bit immature, and actually strengthened the resolve of protesters. You know, we saw sprinklers being turned on, we saw loud music and a speaker's voice being blared from the parliamentary speakers. All that did was to create a festival environment and strengthen the resolve of the people who were there. And I think we just need to leave it to the police, expect that they'll do the right thing, and in time the protest will move on. I think politicians like the Speaker getting involved has only aggravated the situation.
That was Deputy Leader Brooke Van Velden from the ACT Party.
You're back on The Wire with Christina and Jemima. We have one more piece of news for you right after a quick break.
Oh, that's true. Did you see her fascinating?
A toast to that perfect blend of comfort, protection and breathability. Yes, I'm wearing socks and sandals right now. The wool, the leather, it's enough to make you feel a little animalistic. Yeah. Yeah.
Shaky Isles Coffee. Brewed different. For soiree sophisticates and footwear fanciers. Go to shakyisles.co.nz.
Parents and caregivers can now get their 5 to 11-year-olds immunised against COVID-19. Find out more at bookmyvaccine.nz. Or call the COVID Vaccination Health Line on 0800 28 29 26.
Wow. Music's everywhere. It's like a cloud of art. Here at 95 BFM, we've sucked up some of the best contemporary bangers, bottled them and chucked them into a special Spotify playlist just for you.
The February playlist features Aldous Harding, Dead Forest, Cuckoo Chloe, Benny Salvador and more. Follow 95 BFM on Spotify for our monthly Spotify playlist and stay au fait.
It's music. 95
agenda. Go to 95bfm.com for show podcasts.
Can anyone explain why the modern day whales are so big?
The Wire.
3 weeks of unseasonable intermittent rain followed by the weekend's cyclone have caused widespread damage to arable crops up and down the country. This includes crops such as cereal for animal feed, maize for grain and silage, grass and legume seeds for pasture and amenity, and high-value vegetable seeds. Anika talks to Colin Hurst, Dissemination National Board member and arable chair for Federated Farmers New Zealand, about how our farmers are affected.
So, to start off with, would you mind maybe just giving us some background information on how these rains have resulted in what some farmers are calling the worst harvest in recent memory?
Yeah, well, the thing about the harvest, and a lot of it's centred in Canterbury, probably between 80 and 90% of the grain harvest and seed harvest in New Zealand is in Canterbury. And normally we get on pretty good with good weather through harvest, but we have the rain and then normally it would clear up and we get things going, but then we have a couple of days of good weather, then it rains again. So after rain you need a few good days for it to dry out and then we're away harvesting. But when you get rain every second or third day, and then it's sort of winding back the clock every time, and some of the crops have been on the ground for up to a month waiting to be harvested, and it's just deteriorating. Some of the crops like the peas and white clover are actually sprouting before they're harvested, so that just makes the crop worthless, basically.
So would you say a pretty big part of this as well is that these rains are unseasonable and weren't expected, so they weren't able to prepare for them?
Well, yeah, it's very unseasonable, no question about it, but you can't prepare for something like this. You just need things to be dry, to be harvested, otherwise they just don't separate. The seeds don't separate out properly. Sure, we can dry stuff in with blowing dry air through them, but that comes at a large expense. We seem to be getting more and more of these weather events around the country, so this may have an impact on the supply of bread in the South Island, because a lot of the likes of wheat gets made into flour and then obviously baked into bread, so may have a bit of an effect there. We're still trying to quantify that.
And just going back to the large expense that it would be to dry out these crops, would that expense maybe not be worth it at the moment because it's so unpredictable what's happening with the rains?
A lot of our growers do have this equipment to dry out the crops, and we've been certainly on our farm we've invested in this expenditure because we seem to be getting more unreliable harvest conditions. So it all comes at a cost, but therefore, if we don't, we can lose these crops. And in fact, I've got one crop of peas that will be 100% written off. You know, that's a 19-hectare paddock. I think it's going to cost us about $60,000, so, which is a pretty big chunk of money for us.
Yeah, and I was also just wondering what kind of pressure these farmers are under for being unable to supply this high demand.
Oh, yeah, it's huge. It just plays on their mind. I mean, we haven't had the impact of COVID factored into all this as well. And the other thing is the shortage of staff on our farms. You know, a lot of the uni students, especially in Canterbury, like the Lincoln ones, have all headed back to university. So normally they are helping on the arable farms with the harvest, and they'd be pretty well most of the way through before they went back to university. So a lot of them gone back this last week. So we're down on staff as well because of that. The farmers are going to be working longer hours and all the stress that goes with.
The shortage of workers, is there any way to sort of combat that apart from having that additional pressure on the farmers? Is there anywhere else that those workers could be sourced?
We're thinking of approaching the government to... I know this happened in Australia, that the Australian government went to the... especially all the workers involved in the government departments to see if they could be released from their normal jobs just to help the harvest. I'm not sure if that's something we'd look at in New Zealand, but certainly we're putting it up for consideration. Just an example, I've got a son, Matthew. He's a surveyor based in Christchurch. Like he can drive harvesters as a young lad. He's always done that. He helped us with his university holidays. So there's a bit of capacity around the country if we could probably just get them released from their normal job. I mean, COVID's going to be a factor playing on this too, because it looks like that's going to hit us as well.
Yeah, which does restrict mobility around the country as well. But yeah, for something like that to be in place, you would need quite a lot of support from the government, right?
I think so. It's just, look, in reality, in a normal year, February is their full-on month. And here we are, you know, we're halfway through February. We haven't done any of our wheat harvest at all. So, you know, we would normally be almost about 70% our way through. So it's just everything's going to be ready at once when the weather does come right. So it's just putting more pressure on us.
Now, I know we did sort of briefly touch on the economic effects, but just sort of in a more general sense, how much is this economically affecting farmers at the moment?
We still haven't quite analysed it out, but for some farmers it'd be very significant. Look, it could be up a couple hundred thousand dollars for some of the really larger farms and the smaller ones. And depending on their crop mix, you know, for example, ourselves, you know, I quoted $60,000, but, you know, we're $60,000 to $100,000 down on income. Yeah, so that's just something we hadn't really forecast. Look, we're facing higher costs with everything. You know, electricity's up, fertilizer's up, our cost of labour is up. You know, then we're dealing with a lack of income as well. So there's a bit of a gap in the margins there.
And so, yeah, would you like to be seeing some support from the government to help offset these economic repercussions?
Look, we're not asking for a handout at all. It's just a bit of understanding. Maybe some assistance with some, because we may be able to move some grain from Southland, which have had a reasonable sort of harvest to get up to Canterbury, to swap some poor quality wheat around. Look, I'm just uncertain about that. It's the cold, hard reality of commercial reality on this. We just have to lump it, I suppose.
Yeah, because I did want to ask you about what sort of plans are in place or potential plans could be in place to help supply the demand at the moment.
Yeah, well, so normal situation, we had our wheat that would be harvested late January and it was off to get made into flour. So that won't be happening at the normal time frame. So there'll be shortages. Potentially, the buyers will have to look to offshore to import some quality wheat to make into flour. So you just can't ring up on the phone and get it the next day. That takes a bit of logistics to organise with freights, and we all know what's happening with freight, the unreliability of all that going on internationally. So it probably takes a 3 or 4 month lead time for that. So. So we're still in play all this, so yeah, we're just
waiting to see on that. Yeah. Anyway. So I mean, realistically, shortages is going to be something that we're just going to have to cope with in a while.
Yeah, I think so. I hope it's not as bad as that. This is and just we've just got to be conscious that this is only a South Island situation. The North Island is supplied by imported grain, so. Yeah, so it's South Island thing at the moment. So,
okay, fantastic. I think that wraps up just about all the questions I had. But did you have anything else you'd like to add?
Well, yeah, I suppose it does, because the thing is, I didn't talk about the beer, because barley is another crop that in most of the barley that growing in New Zealand gets. Malting barley, and it's made into beer here, so it might affect the beer supply. So it might be a bit short on the beer.
Can't have that. how intensely do you think it will start to affect the beer production?
Because the thing about the beer, so it's malted barley, so they actually get it to grow, and then they interrupt the process, and that's the malt, and that gets made into beer. So. What's happening at the moment, the actual barley crop is actually sprouting and growing in the field. So it just interrupts, which just makes it impossible to make it into beer. So,
And is that something that will be affecting breweries up and down the country?
It's still early days yet with that, but I'm predicting in the next within the next 4 or 5 months that will have a significant effect.
Okay, well, that's definitely something to keep an eye on.
By your B&R students.
That was Nika Mahid speaking to Federated Farmers. She spoke with, give me 2 seconds, I'm just too far down in my little list. She was speaking to Colin Hurst from Federated Farmers about the last few weeks of rain and the cyclone over the weekend causing widespread damage to crops across the country and what that means for the supply chain.
That was The Wire.
That brings us to the end of the Wednesday Wire for another week. Thank you very much to you for tuning in and listening, and thank you for sending through your texts. We always love to hear your feedback on The Wire, so do always keep that rolling in for us. Big thank you to the people who spoke with us for the show today, and obviously a massive thank you to Christina for producing. How do you feel it went?
Thank you. I think it went well this time.
Yeah.
A lot less stressful.
No, it went really well. It was all very smooth, which is nice. Christina behind the scenes is learning how to press all the buttons for you guys. So we're doing that in the background, which is exciting. We hope you have a good afternoon out there and that the rest of your week is lovely. We'll be back with some more news later in the day during the drive show and then another Wire tomorrow at midday. But up next, you've got the 1 to 4 with Bridge, and it's a very musical one. So I hope you enjoy that. Ka kite anō.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.